can't believe anyone would even entertain the notion of each content provider verifying age. Like, oh, you're going to come here. Okay, hold on. Submit your ID. Oh my, I mean, you might as well just light him on fire.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Good to see you guys. You guys camped out for the holidays and sticking around?
Actually, I'm heading out to Utah for a ski trip, family ski trip. So I'm looking forward to it. But I checked the ski report and it's pretty bad. 200 trails, only 7 open. So I'm kind of bummed. But better, as they say, a day in the mountains better than a day at work.
How about you, Mario? Are you going to do some skiing?
No, I'm actually going to go to Colorado, do my annual Colorado visit and do a lot of reading. I hate skiing. And the reason I hate skiing is if you ever seen a blue whale ski.
All right.
That's me.
That's a good reason to hate it. Well, good. Well, I hope you enjoy some good downtime. I'm sure like every year that there will be no shortage of cybersecurity activity through the holiday. So, man, we're going to be just loaded up. But it's already started. We got a lot of good headlines here. So let's start out with a government one. So these are kind of boring compared to things blowing up. And it's even worse when they into all the above. But we got the headlines read, Trump administration turning to private firms and cyber offensive, kind of gave the idea of like mercenaries for hire or that kind of thing, paramilitary cyber offensive operations. And then if you clicked into the headlines, it was generally about, oh, there's a national cybersecurity strategy supposed to be out in January. And it's supposed to be relatively short. It's not out now. A draft circulated to a few people. And among potentially many other things, there's something in there that gives the idea that the private sector might be engaged some way to helping with this. You know, it seems to me like there's precedence for this in security forces in the private sector. What are the limits of engagement here? Are there already rules and customs that would permit this type of thing and, you know, private organizations to be doing offensive security physically, kinetically, or in cyber? And would a national cyber strategy change anything there?
So in terms of precedence, in a broader sense, there is a precedent in the sense of like letters of marque where the government can issue, it can basically request private entities to act on the government's behalf to take certain offensive actions. Now, its application to cybersecurity is going to be somewhat novel, but this conversation has actually been happening for quite some time. And I've been a part of a couple groups where we've discussed it. And I would say that the perspective here is that the Overton window around the acceptability or this being an acceptable option for consideration has moved into that space where the conversations are absolutely have been happening and have been happening for a while. One of the ways I've also framed it is how should we look at the equivalent of stand your ground? So if you're being attacked and the government's not there to help, then what recourse do we have that enables a faster sort of response than through the traditional court system, if the court system even can work right for us? And the reality is that it doesn't work in the timeframes that we need. And so anyway, the conversation's been going around for a while. I would say if as it's being captured in the national cyber strategy, what I don't know is if it's just being floated as a consideration or if it's being explicitly called out. Because in for example, the Biden national cyber strategy, one of the things that was floated was, let's say, software liability. And so it became just part of the conversation. It drove conversation and some degree of action. It got killed under the Trump administration, of course, but it floated the idea. And I think this is what's happening here too. It's floating the idea. I don't know to what degree the final will actually push for it.
Hey, Sunil and Jerry, to me, I think about, you folks might have more experience than I do in this space, but it suggests that we have failed in our offensive. Our government is not capable of doing cyber offensive. What's your sense of that? I mean, when I read this headline, it says, okay, why are we doing it? It sounds like we failed to do it.
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I'll bring up a few things about it and circle into that, Mario. So, like, for one, from the people I've spoken with that have seen the draft directly or indirectly, where this would fall under is a pillar called, like, shaping adversary behavior through deterrence and offensive action. I don't know, and we won't know till we see it, whether or not it means, and these are two very different things, you got an intruder in your network and you could hack back. I doubt it, but that's what we always would come up with and talk about in the private sector. I think that's dead on arrival, but... and won't make it into the national cyber strategy. I could be wrong. Let's see. The other thing, which is how I interpreted this, was, hey, we're going to ping these private startup or whatever they may be, or maybe Booz. It might be Booz Allen or whatever. And we're going to use them for targeting. And yeah, well, Sunil, I know why. Yeah, it's tough for you to imagine them being effective here, but whatever. But, you know, using contractors for operations that the government identifies versus reacting to something. And that's what I'm thinking about here. So back to your question, Mario, does a government need help with their own mission? I don't know. When I think about like Russia and the, you know, kind of tolerated private sector cyber criminal networks that are sometimes acting potentially or sponsored by, the number one reason I could think of is just flouting international law and kind of flying under the radar and not declaring a state level action.
Yep.
Well, so a couple of things to unpack there. There is contractors acting on behalf of the government and all under the auspices of the government. That's already happening today. No question about that. And they operate under a certain Title 10, Title 50 sort of authorities to perform some of these activities. This is different than what I think is being proposed, which is private sector entities, coming from having been at Booz Allen, I would seriously doubt that Booz Allen would put their name on it, so to speak. What you would do is set up a separate entity that is completely unaffiliated that could absorb a much higher degree of risk, have that.
And I'm thinking more like Blackwater. Maybe that's a better.
Yeah, example. Blackwater. Yep, green.
Yeah, so that would be the probable mechanism. But I think the other consideration is in the conversations I've had about this specific topic in various policy circles, this is also meant to be a shot across the bow to folks like China and to some degree Russia that, hey, we mean we're serious about these attacks and we are now going as far as letting private sector act on our behalf to combat these issues. And so that the having the teeth to come back at the adversaries is what this is also signaling as well.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that. So sticking on the .gov area section of the show, if you will, we got some interesting breaking news just eminently that, you know, a friend of ours, a friend of the show, as they say, Kirsten Davies, we had discussed briefly when she was nominated to be the Pentagon CIO, and that's gone through. She went through with a tranche of nominees, and she has been confirmed, and now she'll be the CIO. So you worked with her quite a bit, Sunil, if I remember correctly. And what are your thoughts on this? And talk a little bit about the size of this job.
Yeah, so I had the pleasure of being able to work with her when I was at Booz Allen, of all places. And so it's great to see her career go in this trajectory. I think there's a couple of interesting aspects of it. One is that as a former CISO taking on a CIO role, right? Yeah. I think in the broader industry, we've talked about the merger of the CIO and the CISO function, and who should take it over? You know what happens there. And effectively, the CIO in this case does. Sorry, the CISO and the CIO or rather, there was a CISO function that rolls up under the Pentagon CIO. But to have an experienced CISO be the CIO, I think is really great. Regardless of what you call it, the fact that you have somebody who cares a lot about security in this seat is really great. And the role is primarily, well, not primarily, a lot of it is a policy role. So you can imagine, you know, that trickling down across the rest of the DoD in terms of adhering or pushing or increasing the importance of security policy as a part of what we do. So anyway, all that is to say, I've been seeing Kirsten's journey through the confirmation process for the last, I don't know how many months now, and it's agonizingly slow. It's amazing how slow this confirmation process is, and I can see why, regardless of what administration you're in, why it takes so long to get real stuff done, because, you know, until you have the leaders in place, it's hard to drive some sort of strategy forward. So, one way or another, I'm happy that that we have a leader, and I'm particularly happy that it's Kirsten.
You know what's surprising to I don't know Kirsten personally.
Kirsten.
Sorry.
Well done.
My old dyslexia takes the best out of me. But I've heard good things about her. I've read about her, as well as you, Sunil. You're a big fan as well. My big kind of note here is, it looks like she received 53 votes, yes votes, from the Senate, and nays for 43. Come on, folks. Jeez, this is a really solid person.
I think it goes back to the tranche thing, right? I think they were voting on an entire batch.
Yeah, they were voting on 90 other candidates at the same time. So,
well, they were voting for other candidates. Okay.
Yeah.
My bad.
Yeah, she sailed through the committee. And so it was at the committee level, it was no issue. It's because of the package deal, as Jerry just said.
Yeah, there was some absolute surprised scoundrels bundled in with her. You know, like the Count from Sesame Street got nominated ahead of HHS.
Those one-eyed pirates. But I think the CIO to CISO is actually very interesting. I'm hearing more and more of that, where CISOs are becoming CIOs. You know, as I take more roles, as my role grows also in a startup, I'm also beginning to do the role of a CIO as well as a CISO, and that might be my ultimate. Although I still am a CISO at heart. I'm always thinking security, but maybe I don't know if I like the title CIO. I'm always kind of more a CISO, but it's starting to happen, I think, more and more, as Sunil alluded.
I agree. I've seen it in smaller companies, and I think there was, hey, we don't want to bother buying a CISO, so let's just double hat someone who's already doing IT for us. That might be a trend in cheapness, but seeing it at these high levels is saying something very different, and not just in the Pentagon. A couple other examples come to mind. I think there's even more than this. I'll think of Jamil Farshi. Right, he was a CISO of Equifax, very well renowned, and has been doing this for years. And he's become the CTO, and that's not, you know, just in name only. That's a very big position there. And a CTO in particular is pretty hardcore. And then Chuck Adkins, a good friend of mine, who was the CIO at the New York Stock Exchange, is now a CISO of a company, Acrisure, a big insurance company. I know from working with him that he did a lot in security as he came up through the ranks and ended up in the CIO role. But that's kind of the opposite, right? That's going from CIO into CISO. So I guess there's a lot of interplay. All right. While we're talking about Gov and especially on the initial topic about private sector hacking and all of that, interesting story came out of the Wall Street Journal about Kevin Mandia's next play. He's kicking off a new startup called Armadin. And man, the headlines always, we always have to wrestle with the headlines and decode them. And I think that's our challenge, is to actually read through this enough to see when it's off. The headline said that Armadin will take on the dangerous AI threat. That may be, you know, part of the mission, but what it's really about is using AI for ostensibly offensive operations. Red teaming in particular. And, you know, knowing Kevin's background, and not in the Air Force, but knowing his private sector background and how he rolls, It's completely genuine when he says that red teaming and offensive security under that guise is all about hardening and it's about defense. It's about testing and improving, and that's why he's doing it. But nonetheless, what kind of timing is this that, you know, he comes out with, he's got Google engineers working really hard on AI-enabled red teaming right at the time that this is coming down the pipe from the National Cyber Strategy. If it does drop in January that they're interested in private sector firms helping with government contracts, I can't help but to imagine there's going to be some conversations there. So how's it feel to have another entrant around here? And, you know, that we've heard about AI-enabled red teaming. Do you feel like that space is getting crowded or that it hasn't really been done well yet?
All right. So if you're familiar with, there's a book called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. And one of the basic premises behind the book was, it got codified as Linus's law. Sufficient eyeballs makes all bugs shallow. And the perspective is, that gave a perspective as to why open source might be superior to closed source because you have more eyeballs looking at it. It points to a more fundamental question, though, which is, are bugs and thus security vulnerabilities, are they sparse or are they dense? If you keep looking, will you find more? Or we actually find all that there is, and then there's fewer and fewer to ever find. And I think the general consensus across the software community is that software bugs and vulnerabilities are dense, meaning the more you look, the more you'll find. And so the more eyeballs that we have, the more we'll find. And as we start unleashing more and more of these machine eyeballs, the more that we'll continue to find. And that doesn't really portend well for defenders because now we have to go fix all these. Now, if we're fixing them manually, of course, we're not going to ever catch up. If we fix them through AI, through the help of AI systems, then we actually have a chance. So I think in the context of any of these companies that are coming out, I don't think we need more eyeball companies. Okay, we certainly, I'm happy to have eyeball companies that will have eyeballs that will find these things. But I think we more desperately need companies that can actually go and fix what's found as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, coming from a red team heavy background, when I think about how we would operationalize red team findings, the frameworks and the workflow that had to be established in advance of doing a test was all that mattered. Because I see so many organizations that get an engagement done. And I mean, it's just like everything in our industry. There's so much like flash in the pan, chasing shiny objects, and there's no like durability and no one's taking things forward. So that has to be there first, regardless of how you find things.
Yeah.
The ability to, for one, just to really make sense and triage anything that is reported to you and say, yeah, that's really a big deal and this isn't, that muscle has to exist. And having a register and a way to get things assigned, and if it's going to take 6 months, awesome, but that's okay, and you're going to follow up and not lose interest in it in 30 days. If you do that, you're 90% of the way towards security. And then when you plug in the identification methods, AI-based red teaming could be the next best one, sure.
Yeah, and one other consideration is, so finding them, fixing them, but fixing them in a way that doesn't break everything
correct.
Is also the other correct. Massive issue. And if you consider, there was another article recently where Microsoft said, hey, guess what? We finally fixed RC4. Like after I don't know how many years. You have to recognize there's a reason. I mean, it's not that they couldn't have just gotten rid of it, right? That would have been easy. That wasn't the issue. The issue was there were so many other dependencies that we had on top of that. So I think going back to the premise that we're going to find tons of bugs, tons of vulnerabilities, even if I had a fix for which, again, the RC4, the fact that Microsoft had this protocol that was being used and they couldn't deprecate it for many, many years, despite the fact that they knew that people were taking advantage of it and abusing and getting a lot of people compromised because of it, and yet it took this long to fix it. You can't say it's because of a sheer negligence or stupidity on Microsoft's fault. You know, there's a lot of reasons behind why it couldn't have been fixed until now.
I don't think, I think the automated fixing is definitely become more and more prevalent. My question is, how do we embrace this in a safe manner? So Neil, you talked about makes total sense. You know, how do we avoid breaking our systems or bringing down the environment because we erroneously fix something? But let's just say we're going to agree we're going to do this. How should we think about it? Where do we focus on? What area in the environment can we throw this stuff at with reducing without impacting the productivity in the company?
Yeah, you know, I think it comes down to like Chaos Monkey, right? And that kind of idea about agility, remediation agility is what we call it. And to me, that's the number one metric in evaluating the security maturity of any organization is remediation agility. And to have good remediation agility, you know, it means that even non-security stuff that you can do it safely. You know, a good friend of mine, John Rogers, he talks about like currency, right? And having everything always at the latest available safe version, regardless of whether it's a security issue, as being like almost like a cultural set. Like once you get to that, which, you know, isn't worth it, the ends don't justify the means just for that. But by the time that you figure out what it takes organizationally to support that, then the security fixes are pretty easy too. Yeah, I'd say in general. But hey, going back to Sunil's point about RC4, I completely agree with you in that, you know, that was another risk register item that an org knew about and couldn't fix for, you know, 20 years, I bet, plus maybe. And that's kind of the key point there. I totally agree with that. But I'll use that example, though, to talk about something else where the headline is about them deprecating RC4. And there literally is a headline on this. And it says, Microsoft will finally kill obsolete Cypher that has wreaked decades of havoc. And that's just not true. It's not accurate. Like when I talked about the triaging things and setting the priority right and how important that is, that's a really good example. I would say Microsoft triaged that and said, it's not that big of a deal. And that's why it hasn't been fixed for 20 years. And not that it was just that hard. Because I checked my logic on this, because in the article, it went on to talk about Kerber roasting. And anyone who's grown up in an AD domain and done a lot of this red teaming was always enjoyed Kerber roasting when the teams would use that. But it cited that to basically say like RC4 and the use of RC4 and its brute force ability was a key ingredient in Kerber roasting. And that didn't feel right to me. Like I thought there were a lot of other conditions that had to be present for Kerber roasting to succeed and that RC4 wasn't the key to that. And when I double checked on that, you know, that plays out. Like it had to do with service accounts having SPNs cut and the base passwords behind those service accounts being relatively weak. And, you know, talking to a few red teamers, they basically said, for one, they do and have done in AES environments, so a much stronger protocol. They've successfully performed Kerber roasting attacks. And that it basically means when it comes down to the cracking piece, weak passwords are going to get cracked either way. It might take an hour instead of 8 seconds now. And really good passwords and 48-character randomly generated passwords weren't going to get cracked even if they were RC4. I mean, it's not that you're cracking the password.
No, Jerry, I'm going to push back on that. If there's a window that's open in the house and it's accessible from the street, but as a criminal, I'm going to go through the front door and I'm going to mess around through the front door even though the window's open. So I was just playing around, Jerry. I think you're right.
No. You know me. I love to jump on the metaphors. Like to yeah, me, this but, isn't a window yeah. or a door. It's that the insulation has a lower grade of fiberglass in the wall. Like what?
There
it's,
you go. Exactly.
Pretty much immaterial.
Exactly. I think you're right. I was just joking around. I could not agree with you more.
Well, the point I was making with that one wasn't certainly there's the vulnerabilities issues associated with it or the weaknesses issues with it, but rather just the general perspective of. Even if an AI system can find a flaw, even if an AI system can fix that flaw, there's a whole nother aspect to how the business runs that also needs to be addressed as well. And that is not oftentimes an easy technical patch, right? It's a process patch of some sort. And that is much harder to institute in today's world. I think there is an opportunity for AI systems to help us rejuvenate, revitalize, reevaluate processes, business processes, and see what happens when a system breaks and how do we recover from the outage of a given system. Because that's essentially what we're trying to deal with when we update a system, whether it's a security patch or a feature update or a bug fix. It may destabilize the system. The system goes down, and then now our business processes are destabilized. And it's that last part that we're most concerned about. And I think we'll have to figure out how AI can help in both finding the fixes, but also fixing the process itself.
I mean, there seems to be a lot of companies in the AI space that are targeting the process, business process, everything process, right? I see that more and more. So I think you make sense. And this is what's difficult for me, getting stuck between you two guys, because both of you make sense. So one minute I'm thinking Jerry, but then Sunil, that's a good point as well.
Yeah, again, my point is just to generalize the problem space. It's not about we're going to see a lot of companies out, AI security companies that come out and say, hey, we'll find more bugs. Some of them will find fixes. Just as a data point, with the DARPA AI Cyber Grand Challenge, of all the bugs that they found, of all the security flaws that they found, I think it was something like 70% of the things that they found, they were able to produce a patch as well. Whether it's going to be 70%, whether it'll get better, like, 80%, 90%, I don't think we'll ever get to 100%, which means that there's going to be a delta between that which is discovered and that which can be fixed. And that delta will continue to grow, which begs the question to some degree, how much do we want to incentivize and make easier the ability to find flaws?
I think this is your point about process. I would argue a lot of, so easy for us to go and deploy patches every day. The problem is, what happens if you, in the process of here goes a process in the dance of applying a patch, you break some really critical business process. A lot of the times our hesitation for patching things and the speed of it is because we don't know, one, what it's going to do, and two, how is that going to impact the company.
Well, I'll go further than that. I mean, you're totally right, Mario, but what I like about what Kevin's doing here, and I had a chance to talk to him about it a little bit fairly recently, and it's exactly what you would expect. But what's awesome about what he's doing is that, to Mario's point, you don't know what the impact is going to be with patch and all that stuff. 99% of the time, you also don't really, especially as an engineer who's being tasked with fixing something, you don't really know that it's a big deal. Right, it's a GRC said, here's your 18 things you have to fix. And when you look at them, you're like, this is stupid. It's never going to lead to a problem. So that's what your starting point, which is a problem. And the reason is, when we go through and assess things for risk, especially vulnerability scanners, but it could even be like narrative audits and regulatory exams and everything else, there's this laundry list of junk. And by the way, AI-based code defect scanners are the same way. Like when you're looking in code, You don't know whether it's going to manifest in production, whether it's going to be exploitable, whether those methods are going to be exposed, all that. And it's like the difference in if you're driving your car down the road and it starts shimmying, then you have a problem. And if it stops shimmying after the shop, then you're like, yeah, you won. That fixed it. But if on the other hand, you're driving your car down the road and everything's fine, and then you go into a shop and say, hey, I'm just being prudent here. I want you to check out my car and make sure everything's good. Every time you're going to get a list of 14 things that are wrong. Right? Oh, man, the CV joints are looking bad, Jerry. You should get those. You can get all this crap, right? And that's what we do with cybersecurity, is we keep on bringing it to these folks that are really trying to pull one over on us. And then when we get those, we're no good at triaging them. So we dump them into Jira tickets. And now everybody hates us. And by the way, we're burning shareholder value. It's not just about engineers' feelings getting hurt. Right, they're wasting time. So, I mean, I like the idea of having currency on everything as just a steady state. Once you get there, then it's a sunk cost, and then that's fine. But if we're just trying to fix every single thing that comes up without a video of what happened, then it's kind of pointless. And what I like about the red teaming, and therefore what Kevin's doing, is that when you're done, If you get a list out of that company, if their end goal is a list of things that are wrong and there's no video of all your data getting stolen, then it'll be worthless. But where red teaming shines is when you talk in engineering and you're showing the video of someone exploiting it and all the data showing, right. And then there's no disputes.
Totally.
And if you do break something, no one's going to get fired because they're like, oh, well, it sucks that it's the Cloudflare thing we just talked about, where they felt it was so important to rush through a patch that they caused damage, but everyone's like, hey, that must be worth it. So I think red teaming with an objective, and if you don't show if pictures or it didn't happen.
I think I just heard you call cybersecurity the Jiffy Lube of IT.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the problem, you see. Hey, so speaking of red teaming and actually tying back into that potential for state-sanctioned private sector hacking, and Mario's question about, you know, whether we're getting rusty and are looking for extra help here, or whether it's force multiplication or I put words in Sunil's mouth, showing that, you know, everything's on the table and we're willing to step up to the level. I dug into this one about this, the Venezuela state oil company blaming the U.S. for a cyber attack. This kind of has gotten washed under the headlines around the kinetic interceptions of tankers, and not to mention the drug run boats, you know, that's going on off Venezuela. But digging into this, I mean, it's been going on a week that just the .com website of this state-sponsored oil company, PDVSA, is just straight up down. Like, the .com is down, which is really weird because it, for one, it's weird because it means they're not using Cloudflare. You know, they're probably not using a CDN. What I'm really curious about is the phone calls going on right now when they are calling Cloudflare and asking, hey, quick, can we turn it on? And Cloudflare is about to turn it on. And if someone goes, wait, who's that? Oh, well, hold on a minute. We got to have a meeting about this, right? There might be some really crazy things going on right now if this company's asking for help from anyone. But more importantly, when I dug into it, the websites, we all know DDoS. By the way, it doesn't look like DDoS, but it looks like just good old breaking sabotage. But in any event, those are brochureware marketing, and the oil company doesn't live and die by its website. But oil stopped flowing. It's not been loaded on boats because of this. And I don't know, you know, who's behind it or if it's even a cyber attack, but the unsubstantiated data out right now is that a cyber attack shut down production and loading of oil. Right at the time that the U.S. is trying to step up enforcement of sanctions on moving oil out of there, this could be a pretty big deal. What's your gut on what's really going
this
on?
This smells funky to me. This sounds like garbage. If the United States was doing this, you don't think the current administration would be showing it off? I mean, they're trying to show off all this stuff that they're doing today. To me, it makes like this smells like rotten eggs.
If you mean that they had an IT issue and they're just blaming the U.S.
That's right.
On their own issue, on their own, because it was their fault. It was the state oil company's fault, but it's a convenient scapegoat to say, hey, the U.S. was behind it.
Yeah, I guess what I'd want to see is their operational track record over the past 5 years. And if they have a major outage every 9 months, I'm totally with you. If, on the other hand, this is unique and has never happened before, then I don't know. I mean, it's certainly consistent with the actions and the campaign that are going on. To me, the most dubious bit is this would burn tradecraft, right? I mean, you got to assume all of the United States enemies would be rushing into Venezuela to forensicate this and look at what was going on and how it was conducted.
Usually the U.S. is very quiet about any of its actions. Anytime it's not quiet, it's to make a very explicit point. And that has happened in a couple cases with, let's say, you know, Russia and China and such. But who knows? I mean, maybe if someone is actually trying to make a point with Venezuela, maybe that's what they could have done. But there surely would have been... it would have been clearer that, like, the U.S. would have come around making it more evident that, hey, we mean business here.
They're bragging about putting the largest flotilla that the West Coast has ever seen out there. So we're bragging about all these ships blocking oil tankers. Why wouldn't they brag about this? if it was the United States. This sounds like some IT politic from Venezuela screwing things up and blaming it on the good old Uncle Sam.
Well, I was going to say, we'll see. We might not ever see. But there's a lot of interesting pieces in this whole story, and it's definitely developing as we speak. So, this will definitely be a pretty interesting one.
Revisit it.
And it's worth noting that Chevron, which has some JV with the state-sponsored oil company, but has the approval to move oil out, is not impacted, and they're able to get the tankers loaded.
So the other major consideration, another reason why I would seriously doubt that this is a U.S. action is because as a general norm of behavior, we don't attack critical infrastructure, right? That norm is quickly eroding for various reasons. But it would be quite hypocritical for obvious reasons if the U.S. did actually attack what they would consider to be critical infrastructure, which then, of course, invites attacks against or makes it that much more, critical infrastructure is now considered completely fair game. It's already been fair game to some degree, but now the gloves are off, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I mean, blocking tankers leaving with the GDP's livelihood there is an attack on critical infrastructure. So I would argue that this whole friction has elevated to that point where it's no longer the poking and prodding that might have been governed by those rules of engagement. But again, I guess we'll see. So if it is, and or even if people think it is, you know, some folks might be or some other countries might be jumping in to see what's going on and how it was done. One of those could be North Korea. That brings up the DPRK remote worker thing again. I hear this is not going away anytime soon, but of all the headlines or all the potential threats that could get into board directors' inboxes or CEOs, this seems to be the one that everybody pays attention to, resonates the most, and that people get the most excited about. Like, oh my God, we could have North Korean workers in here. We need to find them now. People are really spun up about this. And I don't think the tech industry or the HRIS industry, I've kind of gone through all of the potential solutions to this, and I haven't seen anything very reliable for preventing this. I mean, the best defense I've seen is, oh, well, they wrote really good code, so who cares? But a story came up about Amazon busting someone, and they said they purported to use, and I don't know why they would share this, but keyboard latency. And it sounded from reading the article like, for one, that they had managed devices issued to employees and required for use. And that alone, by the way, is a huge hurdle for most companies to even get there. So before anybody runs away with what they're going to do about this, remember that. And so once they were able to guarantee that the people coding for them were actually using their devices with their security stack, that apparently there was something in that stack that was looking at keyboard latency, keystroke latency, to detect is someone remotely connected to this or not. And that's what fired, and that's what led to them finding this, which I think is going to set off a flurry of CISO to CEO and everyone in between communications about how do we get some of this. Yeah. Also, tech-wise, does this approach make sense to you? Is this the hidden piece that we've been missing to find DPRK plants?
So unpacking this particular article a bit further, they did mention they were explicitly looking for this type of delay. So my understanding or my what I discerned from it was they did have some additional telemetry and instrumentation to capture this. And vast majority of us would not ever have captured it, let alone know even to look for it. But that said, if it turns out to be effective without the tons of false positives, I mean, actually consider there's a lot of quite legitimate remote desktop usage, right? So we just have to recognize when it's going to, in what situations will it be fine, what situations might it be potentially problematic. But anyway, that said, if they can fine tune the detection mechanism, I would welcome it in as many places as possible.
I'll readily admit that I'm very surprised that this story just won't freaking die. I mean, please, like this thing should have died like beta tapes of yesteryear, you know, when they just went out of business. The whole technology.
But they're still doing it. I mean, they're still in there and no one's figured out a reliable way to eject them. So,
I mean, I just think this is another argument for somebody out there putting it out to have less remote workers and having people come back into the office. This is a great story to support Amazon's story. I mean, Amazon's been pushing people to come back, their employees to come back to work, right? In their office. Microsoft's doing the same thing. All these people are doing it, right?
Well,
the big companies.
No, I mean, so, even if we have, I mean, that may be the case, but that doesn't diminish the fact that there are North Korean IT workers that are infiltrating into these organizations and to many organizations.
100%, Sunil. 100%. Yeah. Yes, 100%. But the remote aspect is what we're talking about here.
Well, yeah, but disregard that as Amazon. Just pick any clever company that was able to discover this technique. We'd all want to know what the technique was. The fact that it's Amazon, I think you're conflating the, you know, its return to office mandates with the underlying problem.
In Mara's defense, maybe that's why we're talking about it. Maybe that's why I made the news, but. Or why they were willing to disclose their tradecraft to some degree here. But I know, it's an interesting angle. I hadn't thought about that. But let me ask you guys about this, right?
Over and over. It's just, to me, it's not a, you know, it's why is this big news, you know?
Well, let me ask you about this, and Mario, in light of what you were saying. Here's two different scenarios. One is an employee that you thought you hired is actually a North Korean national. You're paying them $180,000 a year. You're doing great work, but crap, you're supporting the regime and violating sanctions. People don't want to do that. Generally, I've seen all executives say that's bad. I want to find that and stop it. None of them have said, hey, as long as I don't know, it's okay. I'm sure there's some out there. But so that's one scenario. The other scenario is you hire someone and they've outsourced their work to someone in India. It's supposedly someone in Canada or the US or whatever, but they've outsourced their work and there's someone or more people in various places, but let's just use India for the sake of discussion around latency and distance, and that's why I'm picking India. And they're working through that laptop. It's not violating sanctions. No one's likely to, you know, have a national security issue over this. It's icky. You just have people that didn't go through your onboarding and someone is giving access to their keyboard to someone else. How different are those? Because the control works for both of those. So if we then say, now we have a reliable way on every endpoint to give a nice dashboard to the SOC that says, here's the people that have some remote control to their desktop. And then like any other hit in EDR, it gets routed to the manager. Is this okay? And then to Sunil's points, oh, yeah, we know that they work remote. Okay. And then those, you know, 16% of them are all ACT. And the balance we check out and, oh, man, this one's outsourced in India. That one is a DPRK IT worker. Is that any different? Is it still the same conspiracy theory, Mario, where that's just an RTO in disguise?
Okay, well, that might be a little bit, what I would argue with that situation. You're saying that contractor you're hiring, you're supposed to be hiring somebody who works in India, let's just say an India nationalist, right? A person from India. But then you're saying that person hires somebody from North Korea to do their work?
No. You hire some dude in the States, and then you find out that they've outsourced their job to someone in India that they could pay a third of their salary to. And
without us knowing,
and they're doing all the coding. It's not just that they're in India or even that they're offshore. If you're a US company, but it says not the person you hired who's doing.
You know, I it just goes back to the code of conduct. I know we poo-poo on policies every so often, but it is a code of conduct to say, here's what I'm going to do. This is what you're going to pay me for, and I'm going to do the work. You know, I respect that. If that same person says, by the way, I'm also going to outsource my work, you're paying me, but I'm going to outsource you to the contractors, let me make that decision as the client to make that decision. But if you cover that and not tell me, I'm starting to question my relationship with you as a vendor client.
There's a whole conversation that's happening amongst consultancies and law firms around the billable hour and what does the billable hour look like in the age of AI?
Yeah.
And there's a general perspective of we now want to pay for outcomes and not necessarily the billable hour. So let's go back to that concept then and say, or to what Mario, you just mentioned. At the end of the day, I just want the outcome. To what degree do I care how that outcome is achieved? Now, the degree to which we care is what we call third-party risk management to some degree, right? But
how's that working out for you?
Yes, exactly. Back in the Bank of America days, I remember, that was hard. Third-party risk management is hard. Now imagine trying to do that with fourth parties and fifth parties and sixth parties and you know, just keep going down. At some level, it's just not, it's just, you can't really manage that type of risk at with so many different levels of dependency away. At some level, we just say, you know what? What's the outcome that I want? And am I willing to outsource that to some unknown entity or bring it in-house?
But it depends also on the work that they're doing for you, Sunil. I mean, if this is critical work or part of your work that's going to support your key clients, I think you want to have some level of visibility and transparency between parties. I think it's just one of transparency, and I believe I want to build trust with the people I work with my clients, my vendors, my ecosystem. And when somebody crosses that trust, I don't know if I want to do business with you anymore.
Well, then, and fundamentally, then that does require an in-person engagement or in-person interaction.
That's potentially, yeah, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think no matter what, people don't want to, people want to know that the person that they've hired is doing the work. And if not, I think what everybody's agreeing on is they at least want to have a chance to vote on that and not done without their awareness and approbation. And so, I think this will be a huge space tomorrow. And I kind of hope the incumbents, like the EDR providers, just make this a feature, like remote detection. And by the way, I'm sure someone will say, oh, they've already had it. Well, no, they didn't. Because if you have something that's buried away under 5 million options, you might as well have it. All they got to do is put a page on their website about it and throw out a bunch of spam about how this feature, even if it's been there forever, I don't mind. Come up with a cuter name for it and put it up higher in the UI and call it DPRK IT worker detection, whatever. But I almost want one of them to just go ahead and do it because we have the coverage, right, on the endpoints already anyway, and just sneak that in there. And as a society, we can very quickly operationalize it and get a good feel for whether this is effective in the scale of the problem. Yeah. The alternative being some startup is going to come out, and this is probably going to be all the above, but some startup will come out tomorrow morning, you know, and they'll have raised $120 million at a $600 million valuation because they can do DPRK, and it'll be all about latency and cutting edge. Quantum will be involved somehow, and then we'll just all burn money and go in a cycle and nothing will come of it. So it's all calm down. There's something here. It can be done. It's not rocket science. But I think that the latency thing is a good idea and that we should have the ability to know who's on keyboard and whether there's a remote user on a device or not. All right. Switching gears. We didn't talk about this. It's been a little while now with Australia banning social media for kids under 16. But the reason that it came to our attention in the prep for this show were, and this isn't, you know, something that's just breaking, but the implications if people go to age verification in general. Like, how do you tell the age of somebody and do it in a way that's privacy preserving? It's at odds. I'll say that at a minimum. Figuring out how old someone is somewhere close to figuring out who they are or anything about them, and that's not in vogue. So is it worth it? Is there a way to do it securely? Is it ring-fenced? Is there a certain technological approach that is wiser than others? You know, we all have kids, so I know I have strong opinions about the internet when it comes to my kids, and I'm not very happy with the state of affairs right now. I'd like to do something to keep them off of 97.3% of the internet. So it's appealing to me, but I get it. There's some privacy hits to it too. Where do you guys stand on this argument right now?
So I would actually bring it to under 13. Actually, no,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
The age.
Under 16. Yeah, you're right.
13 would be 13, 14 would be the anyway, there's a debate on that. But anyway, the question of implementation, there's a debate. I think it manifested on Instagram about with respect to Instagram or WhatsApp, one of the social media apps, in terms of who's really the entity that should do the age verification. Is it the app providers? Or my opinion would be, should it be like the Apple, Google, Microsoft of the world that operate the devices themselves? And the perspective here is that if you had Apple, Google, Microsoft, the device operators, they would pass, like we as parents can specify that here is a device that is owned by a child. And that device then communicates to these app providers to say, or the app providers communicate with the device to say, does the device itself belong to a child or an adult? And it's a simple check. It doesn't require, it doesn't violate privacy in any sort of way, but it does provide a mechanism that the content owners can use that is pretty solid, because we as the parents are actually specifying the age on the device. You know, here's somebody who has this device with this particular age.
Is this your original thought, or did you read this, Sunil? I mean, this is freaking really brilliant, really simple, clean method of identifying. Where did you read this, or did you come up with this idea yourself?
No, that's definitely not mine. It's really a part of the debate of like who should have that responsibility.
Yeah.
I mentioned the executive order, the Biden cyber strategy, that one of the things that I had hoped would survive into the Trump administration was the age verification checks. So that was actually in the cyber strategy in Biden's administration. It didn't get carried over into the Trump one, but I think it's one of those things that has a huge amount of bipartisan support. And now it's a question of where's the right place to implement it.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm thinking of my own kids, right? I have kids who are under 13. If they're using their Apple Watch, they can't have their own account. They can't have their own iCloud account. They belong to a parent account, but then identifies that as being the child's device, et cetera. That's a good, clean way of doing it. I never thought about it. That's a very useful way of doing it. Simple.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if we use a concrete example, like, I guess dual use technologies. I think that's didn't that phrase come around like in Desert Storm and you know, whether aluminum tubes could be used for weapons of mass destruction and construction. So there were sanctions that were different for dual use technologies. The same thing comes up with like websites, right? Like YouTube, to me, I use the term dual use technology because the teachers want to have these, you can't learn Spanish unless you watch a YouTube video, which boggles my mind, but whatever. And then at the same time, the other 97.3% of YouTube is just absolute trash. And so you end up with like these in-app restrictions you could have if logged in with your account or whatever it may be. I don't like, and I can't believe anyone would even entertain the notion of each content provider verifying age. Like, oh, you're going to come here. Okay, hold on. Submit your ID. Oh my, I mean, you might as well just light him on fire. It's going to be a disaster. I think the only plausible is identity based, and like you can't get into YouTube because we require coming with an IDP that's one of these blessed IDPs that have signed on to the age blah blah blah, and we're going to get an OAuth claim that is, we'll make it really generic, just like yes no above 16 or below, right? You know, not the actual birth date or anything like that, and then that provider is the one who's going to do the verification. I think there's some possibility there. Now, is it going to allow them to not go to BitTorrent or Pirate Den or someone who doesn't sign on any of this crap at all? Of course not. And the only way to do that is to get into the ISPs, and then I don't like that idea at all.
I want to follow up on that YouTube story. So I ended up trying to create a filter to protect my kids when they're on YouTube, right? And let me tell you, there was just an uprising by my children. They were ready to like just storm the castle. Because it turns out, for example, they needed to study AP Euro history. But if you had the filters about, you know, things where... mayhem or wars, things that are being blocked because of those topics, the whole thing about APU history is nightmarish, right? There's just blood and gore everywhere. So my YouTube filter was blocking my child's education or ability to get an education. Yeah.
I had a conversation with my middle school son recently that ended with me saying, I'll take the zero. And in the middle there was, but in order to do this, I'm supposed to use the Minecraft and I'll take the zero. You know, because
you'll have your kid get an F on the test, really?
Oh, I mean, come on. Yeah, I mean, in a world where just remembering about the assignments and actually turning them in on time and all that is such a challenge already anyway, like an intentional zero would be a breath of fresh air. But the reality is with pushback, it's rarely, oh, we have to. It's always like, you know, do a Minecraft world or build a diorama. Yeah. Here's some paste, some Tinker Logs. Let's go. Like, it's a bluff. Yeah. And so you don't need YouTube to learn about. But anyway, your kids are a little older if they're in AP history, so they could probably handle a little YouTube better.
AP Euro history.
AP. My goodness. When I was a kid, yeah, we had like three AP classes, but alas. Oh, by the way, game time call out here. I just learned in the last 2 weeks that there's apparently a course called AP Cybersecurity.
Oh, interesting.
That's news to both of you, too. And I pinged the college board to say, who runs this thing and what are they teaching kids? And do you need any help with this thing? And got a contact with someone. And I'm going to keep going on that. But I think that's absolutely fascinating to imagine. And we'll reexamine when I learn. I'll bring up what kids are being taught.
Wow.
I hope it's not pure hack lore and don't use public Wi-Fi. And, oh, God, I'm afraid it's going to be. We'll see.
RC4s.
Right, I'm just trying to think for like 2, 3, 5 years in the future. No, actually, no. Like 10 years in the future. Is there an AP AI something?
No, maybe about 10 days. That's got to be coming tomorrow.
I think it's next week.
That's already happening in Palo Alto.
That was yesterday.
Yeah. Mario, go walk down the street. I'm sure you can find somewhere that's doing that right now. Yeah. Hey, so one other thing that popped up very recently. So I guess it was a Black Hat EU that Tom Gallagher at Microsoft was doing a talk. And what he was basically saying is that we're changing the way we approach our bug bounty scope. And the key line was in scope by default. I love this. I welcome it. The nuances have to do it, whether it's somebody else's software or whatever. But if you can get to the end objective, then we are willing to pay you a bounty and we need to get that fixed because hackers don't care about how they did it. They just care about doing it. I love that. And I run into a lot more pushback on doing bug bounties at all. And when I find them at companies, a lot of times I look in the scope and they're so paranoid and petrified that they're limited to just things that are pointless and the attackers would never do anyway. So I think all companies should have start with, don't break anything here. Don't steal all of our data. But if you could find any ways that people could do any of the above, start poking and let us know. Do you guys agree or do you feel like the conservative approaches to bug bounty scopes or any kind of testing scope are justified?
I was past tense a strong supporter of bug bounty. I'm not sure exactly what the future holds here when we again have AI systems that will submit bug bounty findings. If you're as well resourced as Microsoft, great. But if you are the maintainers of curl or FFmpeg or of any number of other libraries that that you're just putting your volunteer time in on, it's not a sustainable approach here. So I think for companies like Microsoft and the big providers who can sustain the effort that's involved in addressing any bug bounty reports, I think that's great. I just don't know what that portends for everyone else who doesn't have that sort of resources that they can throw at the problem.
So you're thinking that if you don't have the budget and the people resources, that other potential competitors are going to be impacted and not be able to keep up with the power of some of the bigger players. Is that kind of what I'm reading you saying that?
Yeah, there was
interesting.
I forget the name of the project, but there was a maintainer of a pretty important project I think it's like libxml, if I recall correctly. A pretty significant package that is baked into a lot of things. And they basically said, look, from now on, any bug bounty reports or any vulnerability reports are going to be treated as a bug and be disclosed immediately.
Mm.
There's no like 90-day, you know, holding time. It's going to be disclosed immediately. So if you want to report something to us, just know that I'm going to immediately disclose it to everyone so that they can, if anyone wants to take advantage of it, they could. All right. So what does that mean for the defenders who are actively trying to find these bugs? So that it goes back to the very first part of the conversation: are bugs shallow or are they? Dense or are they sparse? If they're dense, then it doesn't actually help us to keep looking for them, at least, or to be, I mean, it's an unusual argument. It doesn't help us to look aggressively for them. We should let the attacker look for them, sure. They can spend a lot of time and effort into it. And as soon as they find something, or as soon as you find something unusual, we go fix it as quickly as possible. But should we actually spend an inordinate amount of time finding new stuff when we know that there could be a potentially infinite pool of those?
Well, I mean, I think a key element in here that we're lacking to discuss is the vantage point. And what's unique about bug bounty, and I really love about it, is that it has an external vantage point by default. You could, and it's kind of weird and rare, but you could like allow authenticated access or internal. But generally, you're talking about what I call is like from the Holiday Inn. Like, what could someone do from the outside? So as long as the scope, I mean, I think I like the scope of everything's in, go nuts, but a big piece of the scope is defining what are the bounties in the different levels. And that can very well say, like, sweep all of the annoying crap, like RC4 cipher support or whatever it is, down to either a $0 bounty, thanks, we would give you a kudo, or a $100 bounty or something like that. And I think as long as that's done where it says like, look, the $2,500 bounty for a small mid-sized company or the $2.5 million bounty for Microsoft, it's got to be the hot one that like, man, if this was an adversary instead of you, we would have headline risk right now and we'd be in the news and engaging Mandiant. So as long as you scope it right to where the funnel dumps all the crap down to a lower priority, I don't believe in artificially tying their hands.
Okay, if you're mandating this, I see Sunil's point as from an economic perspective, more of a barriers of entry. The smaller parties are not going to be able to keep up with the bigger players, and the bigger players are going to just, earn the business. Still,
the other consideration, the other part of the picture that is oftentimes quite hidden from many eyes is the arsenal of 0 days that people have. We think that we're making a dent and making 0 days hard to find, and they are generally harder to find. Yes, I agree. But don't believe whatsoever that the attackers don't have a arsenal of 0 days just waiting to be used, particularly those that are highly motivated and can either find them themselves or can buy them off the market. So if you look at the market for exploits, it is a very thriving market, which suggests that people are continuing to find this amongst the very dense set of bugs and vulnerabilities. There's plenty to find, it's starting to get really interesting in terms of what do we want to do about these, especially when you're dealing with developers that are not as well resourced as Microsoft.
Remember last 2 weeks ago, we had this talk where we looked at the report for, I forget who it was. Now I forget who it was because the annual report, and we saw the vulnerability spiking up from the year 23 to 24. And it was a significant growth. Again, brings me back to this whole, what you're talking about, Sunil.
Yeah, there's two elements to that growth. One was is the attack surface, the size, the amount of software that's out there grown. Of course, the answer is yes. But it also points to, the number of vulnerabilities and bugs out there is quite dense.
Yeah, yeah. And just because you find a lot of stuff doesn't mean it all was bountyable, so to speak. Like, I mean, there's nothing like putting a dollar amount of something to really light a fire under people to triage things right. Because in orgs right now, they're dumping P5s, to use like Bug Crowd's terminology, which means a nothing burger.
Yeah.
We're dumping those into Jira tickets with no distinction whatsoever.
Yep.
Because there's no cost to it, but there is a cost. Like, we know that it's a massive cost. It's making the competition beat us, because instead of the latest thing, we're out there, patching or deleting jar files off of disks that aren't used anyway. So the bounty's awesome because it puts a price on that, and it's a pretty good frame of thinking too. If there needs to be, and I call this GRC. Like, I think this is like what GRC should really be doing instead of just compliance and SOC 2 all day. I think what they should be doing is brokering all the findings, whether they're from tools or auditors or third parties and customers, and the engineers and the people fixing them, and getting in the middle of that and, you know, having the wherewithal and the chops to stand up and say, no, this is acceptable. We're okay with that. Turn it off. So bug bounty wins in that case.
You're sounding like you're embracing the fair framework. I thought you didn't like fair.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's what it sounds like to me a little bit.
Oh, man. Yeah, you kind of cornered me on that one. Crap. Yeah. Right, because, I mean, on one hand, if the bounty hunter, if they submit something and then you're going to engineering, you're like, yeah, here's a video. And by the way, we're paying $3,500. Why? Because it meets the criteria. I love that. It's quantified risk. But if, on the other hand, you find something through the Vuln scanner and you say, oh, this is a $1.27 risk because of fair, I'm poo-pooing all over that. That's just stupid to me. So what's the difference? Well, I'll take that away and study it come up with an argument.
Sorry.
I'm actually giving a talk at the RSS. So I got one of the few, I guess, folks who got accepted for the conference next year. And the talk I'm giving on is different ways to think about quantifying cyber risk, and not just using dollars, but using other forms of measurement. But the one interesting thing about how we measure risk is we oftentimes don't measure the negative externalities. When we look at a bug bounty dollar value, you know, the finding the type of bug has a $2 million bounty, let's say, that captures an element of what the attacker is trying to how we reward the attacker. But the actual negative externalities of that bug and the effects of that bug are far greater than just that $2 million, right? It's you can argue it's like 10 times, 100 times, maybe 1,000 times larger than the actual bug bounty.
Sorry, Sunil, please finish your point.
Well, anyway, my general point is that negative externalities are really hard to measure, but that's the stuff that we oftentimes actually experience when we get breached because we didn't patch or something like that.
I found this argument of negative externalities hard to sell to the executives.
Absolutely. Climate change.
So, yeah. Yeah. So I see your point. It was for me personally, it was hard to do, or professionally, it was hard for me to do that.
Thanks for making that distinction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. It's hard to do with the dollar values because it's so abstract.
There you go.
But I think part of the whole risk quantification, if we only use risk dollar values, then you end up not being able to properly capture the negative externalities. If you can use other units of measure, it ends up being potentially more effective. How many puppies will die when you don't patch this?
Yeah. I mean, I still think what you'll find is you'll either come up with lies and things that aren't really going to happen, or you'll find that most of the stuff doesn't really going to have a big dead puppy. And
I feel like this is where we as a profession lose credibility when we go and venture into that. So one, Sunil, kudos to you for trying to tackle this. I love to hear more about it and see your talk, because I like to learn something, because it's a pirate victory for me.
Well, you know where to find them in your hometown, right? You're talking about RSA this year, right? 26 March. Yeah, what is it? March something or another. Yep. All right. Well, good. I'm going to see both of you guys there. I don't have any arrangements made yet, but I'm due, so I'm definitely going to be.
And Sunil, this time I'm going to kick Jerry's butt going up a hill.
Now we're talking.
This is going to happen. This is going to happen this time. We're going to talk about it.
All right. We're going to do a live podcast recording while huffing and puffing and climbing up Mount Tam. Maybe not. All right, guys. Well, yeah, that's something to look forward to. Wrapping up. So thanks a lot, guys. This was great. We're rolling right into the holidays. Merry Christmas and anything else that you celebrate for sure. This will be great. And I look forward to catching up with you guys just as we're about to roll into the new year.
Thanks.
Merry Christmas.